The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Friday, March 24th, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Repeal and replace, defeat and disgrace.
And just remember, this is not our bill, this is their bill.
Well, that's because yours wasn't a bill. Theirs was a bill, now theirs is a law. A law which, flawed, does provide health insurance coverage for millions of American citizens. You know that, right, Mr. President?
I've been saying for the last year and a half that the best thing we can do, politically speaking, is let Obamacare explode.
And the collateral damage will be millions of citizens of the country of which you are president, yes? Yeah, well, not since the metric system went down hard in the 70s have more people been more pleased by a failure to reform a system that was more criticized. Of course, back then the CBO said the metric system would cost like 12,000 hectoliters or something. And Trump Care was much, much worse than that. Much worse. Although, you know, I'm thinking about it. You know how the CBO said the bill would cost 24 million people to lose health care and the Republicans said, oh, that's not true? Well, now it won't. So the Republicans were right. Dynamic scoring, Trump-splained. When the bad idea never gets the chance to go into effect, that's an odd feeling. It's not certain crisis averted. It's just strongly suspected crisis averted. You know, like that 11th season of Laverne and Shirley, without Shirley, but also without Laverne. Like, could have worked, maybe, Lenny and Squiggy, some backstory. Anyway, what with all the attention to this failed bill, which I will be discussing more in the spiel, it did distract from a lot of other news. I mean, let's just focus on the Russian angle, not even talk about how Congress passed a law to weaken web privacy, or the fact that Hosni Mubarak got Arab sprung from jail. Let's just take the Russian stuff. We got Marie Le Pen vocally campaigning on weakening sanctions against Russia. We got Devin Nunes and his dance of nonsense. We got Paul Manafort paid $10 million a year from 2006 to 2009 at least. And this money was so he could advance the interests of Vladimir Putin in general. But there was another thing that happened in Congress this week. It was about the Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch. Oh, yeah, the Supreme Court nominee. It's going to be boycotted. Anyway, Maria Cantwell, Senator of Washington, took to the microphone and she laid down this diss track.
I wish I could get a famous rapper from Seattle here, Mr. McLemore, because this truly is a heist.
After which Charles Schumer walked up and said, I wish I had a Brooklyn area rapper in here. Because even Mr. Busta Rhymes could tell you, when it comes to assurances over conflicts of interest, Mr. Trump needs to gimme some more. Assurances. It wasn't at all tort. It flowed when Schumer says it. You know how he do. And then Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio just said, in general, of the tone and tenor of the Trump presidency, I wish Ms. Lauryn Hill were here with the Fugees, because you're killing us softly.
Killing me softly with his song.
On the show today, as I mentioned, I will spiel more about the bill that was not. But first, a woman who is Deputy White House Chief of Staff for President Barack Obama. She had thousands of workers under her. She once jumped on Newt Gingrich's car in college. She also paved the White House driveway. All right, I'm going to guess she had a guy do it, but that was her job. She's up next, Alyssa Mastromonaco. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay the neighbor and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we kvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. Any leader promises at least have the trains run on time. But who has that leader's trains run on time? And what if the train isn't a train, but a plane? And what if that plane is Air Force One? These were the daily considerations of Alyssa Mastro Monaco. She was in charge of logistics for candidate then President Obama. Her new book is Who Thought This Was a Good Idea and Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House. Hello, Alyssa.
Hi.
This is a fun book. I will promise readers that it mentions the word vangina, for instance. I want to start with that.
What a vangina is?
Okay, yeah. Because it also gets to the fact that you are in charge of logistics even in your avocational
life.
Even
in my personal life, a vangina is a van you rent to pick up women who are going to a bachelorette party.
Uh-huh. And the reason the bachelorette party shows up in the book is that it was set against one of the typically hectic times of your life.
It was. I was throwing my best friend's bachelorette party, and her shower was happening simultaneous with the announcement that Senator Barack Obama would run for president.
Yeah. So that's kind of a big deal.
It was a big deal
on that campaign. Right. So I would suspect that there is always the temptation to turn to loved ones who aren't in politics and say, how could you possibly be sweating me on whatever mundane detail of their life when I've got the president, the leader of the free world, needing to do that? But I would also suspect that would wear pretty thin if you did that.
So I will tell you that one Christmas, I came home from the White House and I was particularly surly and tired. And we were at Christmas Eve dinner, and my father said, I am not the only person who gets, Alyssa, you are not the only person who gets tired. And so that was the end. That was my pass, and it was over. And so I am just like everybody else.
Yeah. Of course, you know, you had several, I don't want to say Trump cards. You had several chits to play with him. Like, really, Dad? What stressed you out? Was it the NATO repositioning of missiles? Was it that Merkel was going to go off the euro? What was your deal, Dad?
I will say that it was maybe the following year. I was on the phone, and it was Thanksgiving, actually. And he said, he's like, let's get off the phone. And I said, it's the Situation Room. And he like looked at me like I was lying. And then I showed him the phone and actually said Situation Room. So.
Not even the one with Wolf Blitzer.
No,
the real deal. Yeah. Okay. So tell us, your job often expanded to include a lot of things. But,
sure.
When you answered the want ad, which is, I know, not how you got the job, like, or if there was a want ad, what would it have said for what you were supposed to do?
So the one thing that's sort of interesting to know is that from administration to administration and person to person, the two deputies for policy and operations, deputy chiefs in the White House, their roles can change a little bit depending on the person. So for me, it was overseeing all of the White House military office, which is about 3,000 people, mostly military. White House military office oversees the operations and maintenance of Air Force One, Marine One. It runs Camp David. And I oversaw presidential personnel, which reported up to me, which included the political appointments across the administration and also things like interviewing Jim Comey for his job.
Great job, Alyssa.
He is very smart. He's in a terrible position.
Yes.
To sort of what the president did every day and coordinating all sorts of like different activities, leader visits, foreign trips, and anything random, including paving the driveway on West Executive.
So when you interviewed Jim Comey, I know I could have jumped on paving the driveway. Also fascinating. But when you interviewed Jim Comey, you're the initial interview, you give your recommendations to the president. How does that play out? What were you looking for?
So
take me through that interview.
We went, it was myself and Kathy Rumler, who was the president's lawyer, she's White House counsel. And mostly we just go through, you know, we talk to the president first. What are you looking for? And of course, he's like someone very smart.
Yeah.
And so then we met a bunch of different people. And I will say that Jim Comey is one of the most impressive people I've ever met. And then the president will meet with all the different candidates. And sometimes we join him and sometimes he does them on his own.
So now we're witnessing essentially a long job interview, and it's with Judge Gorsuch.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes across as unbelievably impressive, and he has this great manner, and I think he seems to be a man of very high character, right? I would hire him for any job, except maybe the Supreme Court. I mean, this is what the Democrats have to figure out.
Yep.
Because you have to try to suss out where they will rule in policy areas.
Yep.
So with Comey, how does that come into play? It could be the greatest. There could be two people on paper who are as impressive, who have great resumes, who seem to be of high character.
Mm-hmm.
Yet one would make a decision, a hypothetical decision in the future that your administration would disagree with, meaning you would think it's bad for America and another would think it's good for America. How do you figure that out?
So I think it really comes down to sort of like checking someone's judgment. And also with something like the FBI, a real consideration is sort of the rank and file and yes. how they're going to, that's something that we definitely thought about. How are they going to view the person that we put in there? And so for FBI director, you want someone who's cool and steady, who throughout their life has demonstrated good judgment, which he certainly had, and who would gain the respect of the rank and file. And so those were some very important things.
Right. And so you know you have a lot of sources in the FBI, casual sources,
yes.
actual sources. You know he has a really good reputation.
100%.
What does that mean? He's an FBI man. He does the job. He's unbelievably ethical.
Yes.
But what about this question of trying to anticipate, will someone make decisions down the line that you would judge to be not in the best interest of America? Though another reasonable person, maybe a conservative person, might disagree.
That's so I would say that, well, FBI aside, because that's such a long term.
Mm-hmm. 10 years.
10 years. I would say that, like, you know, for Supreme Court, you also want someone who's pretty steady. Like, I don't think Neil Gorsuch is that bad. You know, you kind of want to know how people are going to come down on
yeah.
it. But honestly, look, I mean.
So does he evade on that like a judge would? Do you give him hypotheticals?
No.
No.
No, I didn't. Yeah. I don't know what happened in the other interviews,
right.
but I did not, because that would be like, you know, Elle Woods from Legally Blonde being like, so let's run through a scenario. So I'm very much, I know what I know and I know what I don't know.
Yeah. What about satisfying ethical requirements? I've listened to a bunch of interviews with guys named Norm who talked about it.
Oh, yeah.
he's
a tough guy.
Was it onerous on you? Did it eventually become, not on you personally, but mm-hmm. on the White House? I mean, were there times like, really? This would be seen as unethical? But then does it become second nature?
You know what it is? I think that having, it does become second nature because you want to have, like, you want to have rules that everybody abides by so it's equal. And I think that what they did, it was a pain in the ass, but it was fine.
Were there any things that you'd explain to friends or people who weren't in the White House that you couldn't do because of ethics? And they're like, really?
So one time when I was going to a God Street wine show here in the city, I knew that a lot of people there would be smoking pot. So
yes.
I actually like declared to the office of, what was it called? There's an office that vets you. And I actually
said, I hope the acronym is NARC, whatever the office
it's
is.
I think it's OSEP. I went and I was like, just so you know, I'm going to a God Street wine show and like there might be pot. And they're like, okay. And I was like, I just want to let you know. So that was it.
Smoke.
So it's stuff like that.
Do you have to disclose any time the front man is excessively bearded to a show? Is that like a good rule of thumb?
That's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Built to Spill, for instance.
Yes,
anytime,
exactly.
Like, some cult leader is on stage leading a band.
It was. I'll tell you, I was glad that when the Grateful Dead got back together for their 50, minus Jerry.
The Wrigley Field show?
That I was there for all three.
Uh-huh.
Well, two. That I was well gone from the White House at that point.
What about rules about feet on the couch in the Oval Office?
We did not do that. And that is one of the most appalling things that in
Are
terms
you serious?
Of the, so here's here you're going to get my shtick now
okay.
about what really bothers me
okay,
with what's
okay,
going on.
Okay.
So I am a patriot. Yeah. I think that I am a public servant. I believe deeply in the transition of power in the government, in what the building of the Capitol is, in the majesty and the import of the actual White House. And they have degraded what is essentially the greatest home court advantage in the entire world with how they treat the White House. And watching Kellyanne Conway put her sit on top of her feet, look like she's playing brick breaker, not just in the Oval Office. If it had been just she and Trump, whatever. But in a room with what I think were all the presidents of historically black colleges. She wasn't even talking to them. That is the thing that's like, come on, guys. It's the White House. And it is the one thing that, like, when leaders come, I saw the other day when Angela Merkel was there, who's my favorite foreign leader, they had like taken the interpreters out. It's like they have everything that.
What do you mean they've taken the interpreters out?
So typically you have a very long negotiation with a country when they're coming. And it's like, will the leader speak English? Will they speak in their native tongue? Do you want consecutive or simultaneous translation? Well, I don't know what they did, because when she sat in that meeting, she started speaking in German and there was no translator in the room. We couldn't understand how that even happened.
Yeah.
But it's because everything that we did, which was really protocol and not political, they're basically just like out shooting for sport without actually understanding why those things were there ever for many, many years, way before us.
I'm not going to say push back, because I've literally never been in the Oval Office. So
sure.
I defer to you. But I gave, for all the actual things that Kellyanne Conway has done and said that are appalling or not true, I gave her a little bit of a pass because I remember when George W. Bush got in the White House, the whole thing was Ronald Reagan always wore a sports jacket in the White House and look what Bill Clinton did and George Bush is always going to wear a sports jacket. And then sometimes maybe Barack Obama would just, you know, take his jacket off and be pictured
with. Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So I always said, I do not give a damn what someone wears in the Oval Office. I give a damn what they decide in the Oval Office.
Well, that totally agree. 100%.
And feet on the couch. I mean, I guess she was trying to get an angle for the picture or something. We're in a new world of social media.
I mean, I know. Look, I'm going to tell you that some of my greatest, Valerie Jarrett and Dan Pfeiffer, had this idea when we were rolling out the Affordable Health Care Act to put the president on Between Two Ferns. And I said, I stood up, that is terrible. It is so not presidential. We cannot do this. And I was overruled for a good reason, because it was the most viral thing that we ever did. And that was one of those moments where I was like, you know what? I was wrong. And I tried to and from that point on, I was much more open-minded about things. But it still doesn't change my mind about how they treat the White House.
What about that girl with the green makeup on YouTube that he did the
Glow?
Interview with? Yeah.
Glozell?
I think so.
Yeah, I know.
To me, Between Two Ferns, I mean,
that's
my
thing.
Demo.
It was kind of Between Two Ferns broke the seal.
I have to know, what is it like to be the last black president?
Seriously? What's it like for this to be the last time you ever talk to a president?
It must kind of stink, though, that you can't run, three times,
No, actually, I think it's a good idea. If I ran a third time, it'd be sort of like doing a third Hangover movie. Didn't really work out very well, did it?
How important was either the tone or actually what Michelle Obama, what the First Lady said, in terms of creating a work environment?
So both the First Lady and the president were very thoughtful. When it came to that, the tone was to respect one another, to work as a team, and most importantly, no drama. The leaking that is happening now, I can't even express to you what would have happened if it was clear that the leaks, we would have leaks from other agencies who didn't agree with what we were doing, but leaks that are actually coming from inside the White House. It happened one or two times and that was it, because that's when you get the deeply disappointed Barack Obama, and his eyes get really dark and he looks down at you and he's like, unacceptable.
So this leads to my question, not to deny the current First Lady, her agency, or anyone's right to unshackle themselves from Donald Trump. Is something lost by not having a First Lady there?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing, going back to Michelle Obama, the one most important thing she wanted on Inauguration Day, the day after the inauguration, our first day in office, is that she wanted to put a stake in the ground that the White House was the people's house. Mm-hmm. And tours opened up that day. And backing up from that, one of the first hires that was made was the director of the White House Visitor's Office, who runs the tours. The fact that tours didn't start back up, and making the First Lady wanted the White House to always be accessible. She brought so many kids in. She felt that, in Washington, D.C., there were so many kids who lived there and never got to go to the White House. And she brought them to the White House and she went to them. And so I think it is a huge bummer. Some people would say it's very feminist what Melania is doing. But I think that it's a loss. There is a huge portfolio that Michelle Obama had that is just, and not that every First Lady has the same portfolio, but every one of them, every First Lady I know of, has had a very significant impact on what happened in the West Wing. And, right now, it's just MIA.
Yeah. Well, I'm waiting for the anti-bullying agenda. Well, it's going to set us all on our ear.
And I thought during the campaign, because Melania never seemed quite comfortable, especially after she gave her speech, which she delivered really well and unfortunately was poorly served in that process.
The speech that was largely,
there were chunks that were very similar to Michelle Obama's. Yes. But I thought Ivanka would take a very sort of front and center First Lady-ish type role.
As daughters and nieces have done. I mean, we're going back to Buchanan or whatever.
Right. Yes, but then she didn't, because she was running her business. And now she's, not going over there, but she has an office in the White House. And so it seems more like working in the White House is actually a hobby for her. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it's sad that the First Lady, there is no First Lady for the U.S. right now.
So bring us up to today. I'll ask it this way.
Sure.
The job seems to both over-prepare you for anything
it
in
does.
Civilian life, but also that could be, it could be a letdown. It could be, hey, without all these people behind me, maybe things are different in a 40-person company. So what did you transition to and how's it been?
So I eventually, after I left, I transitioned to Vice Media, where I was the COO. And I liked it because I was drawn to it, rather, because it was very campaign feeling. You know, people on laptops sitting around, nothing too formal. I really wanted to, like, shed sort of the J. Crew shift dress that I'd worn for 6.5 years. And it was hard. It was very hard. It was way harder than I anticipated. It's what made actually writing the book so hard, because I sort of had, like, a crisis of confidence because I had been such a known commodity. And in some cases, whether it was like Jon Favreau, I'd worked with Jon Favreau for 12 years. These people were actually my family. And I hadn't had to prove myself in this kind of way. And also, if I'm being totally honest, didn't think I should have to prove myself necessarily. So that was hard, and meeting all new people and learning about a whole new industry. But I felt like I was young enough and rested enough that I could go for it. It's like, why not? I'll try media.
Did you fit in? Did you fit in with the culture of Vice, which I think is less God Street Wine and more, I don't know, some punk band?
Yes. No, I didn't. I didn't. Though they came around. People, it's like, you know, you have to have an open mind about people. And I think that they thought I was going to be really square and super conservative and have, like, you know, my, like,
the kind of person who would disclose that she's going to a concert where marijuana might be smoking.
Exactly. And so after a while they were like, have you met that woman? She's all right. So it took a couple months to get all right status, but it was fine.
Alyssa Mastromonaco is the author of Who Thought This Was a Good Idea and Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House, because she did, former White House Deputy Chief of Staff. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way, or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. After the defeat of Trump Care, Trump, who you heard from at the top of the show, seemed not to care. But if you call the bill by the name it was issued under before the focus group got hold of it, if you call it Ryan Care, you might have found that Ryan did care.
You've all heard me say this before. Moving from an opposition party to a governing party comes with growing pains. And, well, we're feeling those growing pains today.
Growing pains or growing burst appendix?
We will need time to reflect on how we got to this moment.
You wrote a bill that hurt people.
What we could have done to do it better.
Could write a bill that would help people. And then we get to the part that was like a Razzie Award acceptance speech.
And I want to thank so many members who helped make this bill better. A lot of our members put a lot of hard work into this. I also want to thank the president. I want to thank the vice president.
And now at this point, every cabinet secretary is going, oh, not me. Don't name me.
I want to thank Tom Price.
Damn it. Mulvaney's like, not me, not me.
Mick Mulvaney.
God damn you, Ryan. Trump Care vanished into thin air as the House GOP could not sufficiently agree on an idea beyond Obamacare bad. The Freedom Caucus was the primary scuttlers of the legislation, but moderate Republicans were also not pleased by the legislation because they said this will very much hurt our constituents. The bill, which polled at only 17%, was doomed for a number of reasons. It wasn't conservative enough, it was too conservative, it was poorly thought up, and it was poorly executed. Failure, in this case, has 100 fathers, all of whom were pretty pissed about having to pay for female reproductive services, but there was one main reason it failed. Because a good slogan is not the same as a good idea. And a good idea is not the same as a good bill. And a good bill doesn't even always have to be the same as a good real-world outcome. Repeal and replace with something terrific, the president said. Who wouldn't like that? You know, if you focus on that something terrific part, if you add that to a lot of things, it tends to make the thing sound, I don't know, a little more terrific, trending toward the terrific. By the way, this is Donald Trump's plan on immigration, beautiful wall, jobs, all coming back, the economy, so much winning, and the war. Although to be fair to his secret war plan, Trump didn't really promise us something terrific. He promised us something secret. We're just assuming it would be terrific because he is smarter than the generals. But with Trump care, the closer could not close. The emperor has no clothes. You know, perhaps I shouldn't pour salt in the wounds of the Republicans, but that is the Republican healthcare plan. So now back to the salt mines, tax reform, which is like totally easy from what I understand. It's going to be terrific. The Gist was produced by Mary Wilson, who wishes she had a series of Florida area MCs from the 90s in here, because even the Quad City DJs could tell you when it comes to infrastructure, Donald Trump needs to come and ride the train. The Gist was also produced by Chris Berube, who wrote that joke. Yes, you did? Yes? Okay, very good. Steve Lickteig is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. First, we're going to implode, then we're going to explode, and then he's going to download some movies, perhaps on BitTorrent this weekend. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network, leans no. Strong no. No leans no. Yeah, it's not going to happen. The Gist. You know, I wish MC Hammer, Michael Christopher Hammer, were around to tell us what I think we already know. We got to pray just to make it today. Oom Peru, da Peru, do Peru, and thanks for listening.